Welcome to Black Earth Podcast. I'm your host, Marian Atieno Osieyo. In season three, we're meeting visionary Black women who are creating innovations inspired by nature. In this episode, we meet Tinike Chinime. Tinike is an inspiring scientist and innovator based in Calgary, Canada. She is working with Black Soldier Flies and African Indigenous female entrepreneurs to design a new economic model that transforms organic waste into wealth. Join us for this enriching conversation as we learn how to create economies that promote dignity, well-being, and sustainability for people and our living planet. Hi, Tinike. Thank you so much for joining us today. Could you please introduce yourself to our listener community?
Well, absolutely. Thank you, first of all, so much for having me here. It's pretty exciting, the work you're doing, and the fact that I get to share a bit about what I am doing. So yes, my name is Tinike Chinime. I am a PhD candidate at the University of Calgary, which is located in Alberta, Canada. My research is about developing innovative solutions to waste management, particularly in low-income countries. And I am focusing it mainly on the women who are impacted by poor waste management practices. And the beautiful thing about the project is that not only does it cater to the overarching problem of waste management, it also tackles food insecurity, food security, as well as sustainability and climate change mitigation.
Amazing. And so you're currently in Calgary. Where is home?
That's a very interesting question. So it was actually, and I know this conversation is probably going into a different aspect. It was home is really where I am, because my life has been a very interesting one. I love to travel. My parents have always loved to travel as well. And so I was actually born in Germany, raised there for some years. We moved between Germany and the UK, and then I moved to Nigeria. And then I thought I was home because I was back there with people who looked like me, but it wasn't quite the way I thought it was going to work out. But I went to school in Nigeria, grew up there, spent quite a number of years there, graduated from university. And then I started moving around again, this time with my spouse. We moved I was in Norway, Denmark, did a bit of traveling, Angola, then moved down to Italy, and finally we relocated to Calgary, Canada. So home is really wherever it is I am.
That is a really beautiful reflection. And I think many of us can resonate with that. You know, home is where you find belonging. And that can look differently. It is different for many people, and it changes as you change as a person. Thank you for sharing that.
No. And I just want to add that, yes, especially with globalization, you know, it's just made it so much so that those lines that were drawn for territories and between ethnicities and culture, it's just now blurring so much. So it's really hard to put people in a box. And so that's one of the reasons why I try not to, because people are a mix of everything.
For sure. That really resonates with me also, because I have grown up and spent, you know, a lot of my time having a very strong identity and connection to my Kenyan heritage. And it still is very much something that I feel very connected to. But also as my love for nature has grown, I feel more connected. Home for me is belonging to the earth. And that is more than a specific geography or a territory. It's a relationship. And that takes place between me and Earth as I interact with Earth every day. So home for me is Earth, and that looks and feels differently on a day-to-day basis. But yeah, so moving on and on from that, how would you describe your relationship with nature?
Well, I would describe it with the words curiosity and appreciative. And so the truth is, I am completely and totally appreciative of our natural environment, but because every day that you look out, there's something new to learn, and then you truly begin to appreciate the vast scale of the world we live in, that it's so much bigger than any individual, or even bigger than a collection of individuals. And so there's always something to learn, you know, and there's so many squirrels around here in Calgary, and it's amazing to just watch them and see the personalities they have and see how they interact with the birds and see how interacts with the trees, with the flowers. And so, yeah, it's just appreciative and completely curious. You know, there's always something new to learn. I worked with the black soldier flies, and just watching how they and all the other microorganisms, even the ones you can't see, how they change things and make them from something that's completely irrelevant, or we consider as waste and should be discarded, they turn it into something that's so precious and valuable.
Thank you so much, Tinike, for sharing that. And yeah, bio-waste is going to be a big feature of our conversation, and they'll be featuring the black soldier flies, whom you work with very closely. So I think when I thought of season three, which is innovation inspired by nature, I definitely wanted to talk about and explore how kind of the principles of nature, how nature designs things, how nature creates life, how it can be applied, how we can apply that to our life to create more life-giving cultures. And I thought of the economy just because it's something that it affects all aspects of our lives. And it's also one of the spheres of our human life that needs to change if we're really serious about addressing the climate crisis and nature loss. But I didn't just want to talk about the economy. I wanted to think like, okay, are there economic models that are inspired by nature and nature's principles of life that also center the dignity of African women, that also work in harmony and solidarity with other species? And I honestly thought I will never find this. Well, actually, I didn't think that, but I actually was like, I don't know how this is possible. And then you appeared. And that taught me a very crucial lesson. Everything that you imagine exists, okay? It exists. So I was actually blown away. So I've been so excited to speak with you just about the work that you're doing. But before we get into that, I'm just really curious to find out more about your journey and what led you into this space as a scientist and innovator working on waste.
Well, I guess it was a good thing that I introduced, or you asked the question about where home was, because that gives a bit of perspective on how I consider my place and how I view, I mean, what led to this particular research. And so as an African woman who did grow up in Nigeria and spent quite a number of years there, I could see how patriarchy impacted women. And I really wanted to do something for, you know, to help other women to hopefully improve their situations. And you touched on something very interesting about the economy and how that impacts things. And so I had that idea from the beginning that, you know, if you can improve economic situations for women, then chances are you can also thus empower them, give them freedoms, and allow them to explore things that previously were limited to not considering, but just because they have some source of income, alternate source of income, and they're financially independent, then that could open up doors to the self-discovery as well as discovery of any other thing, as well as giving them education and everything else that they want, for not just for themselves, but also for their family. And so with that idea, I went into this research of, okay, how can we curtail the waste issues that we see, particularly in low-income communities where waste is not collected. And with that, I was looking for simple technologies, simple systems that could be decentralized. And so what that means is really you don't need to have government, so you don't need to have big organizations coming into communities to collect the waste, because the beginning of the problem in these low-income situations is the fact that waste is not collected. And so if waste is not collected, how can they, the people that live in the community, manage to waste themselves? And so enter the Black Soldier Fly. With some research, I came across that. And then the system is pretty popular in developed countries, but because the larva from the Black Soldier Fly is actually used as protein, this insect-based protein that is used in the pet industry. But with that means there's an economic advantage from these flies that can actually convert waste into protein, and then they leave behind a compost-like material, which we can call biofertilizer, because it is organic fertilizer. That's really rich, and it's basically, like, when you think about it, it's waste material. So for instance, fruits and vegetables coming from the earth grown, and then it's wasted, you don't need it anymore. Then these flies come in, they break it down so it can become a rich source of nitrogen, phosphorus. You put back onto the ground and use it to grow more crops. And so it just closed that loop that way. And so it is environmentally friendly. Well, I thought it was. And so I had to do some research, do some tests and analysis to confirm that it is environmentally friendly. And then socially, that was the question. Was it going to, with the system and putting it into a community, will it be socially cohesive? Will it improve the living conditions of the women? And then will it also be economically viable? And so those were the questions I wanted to ask and have answered around the research. And so that's how everything tied in together.
That's amazing. Tell us more about the bio waste model that you've been working on and co-creating, because there's some really unique elements to it as well. Like, as you've just mentioned, working with Black Soldier Flies for waste management, as you know, insect protein that's quite popular and it's actually increasing globally. But what you're working on is novel, and I think is actually very future focused, very futuristic in a number of ways. But yeah, so tell us more about the work you're doing.
Okay, so so the model that I was pursuing was, there's a theory that I had initially, and it was really the fact that having advanced technologies does not solve everything. It does not solve the problem in every situation. And I could, with a little bit of digging, it was pretty obvious that some type of waste management technologies that had been directly imported from the global north to the global south were many times abandoned or left discarded, just because either knowledge transfer or the expertise was lacking, or even maintenance of these systems was not happening. And so in my mind, I had to look for a way of using the same Black Soldier Fly technology that is being used in the global north, but develop a way where it could be simple for the community that will be using it. And at the same time, not too laborious, because these I mean, like not heavy duty kind of work, because these are still supposed to be systems that are benefiting women. So there had to be a balance there. And so initially, going through just the research and trying to find out how do I make sure that this is not a top-down, I'm not using the top-down approach, but more of a collaborative approach, and not just with words, but just actually with actions. And so I had to design the research so that it was in three phases. And so there was a pre-design phase. And this pre-design phase was actually following a strategy that's called co-production, which is closely related with co-creation. And so it was, there's a pre-design phase, and then the middle is a co-design phase. And at the end, there is a post-design phase. And so the pre-design is really just going through literature, seeing what others are doing, trying to model something after what everyone, what you've learned. And then the co-design is where you take what you have, you know, okay, now you're knowledgeable about it. You take it to the community of in question, and then you actually sit down with them, describe what you, what you're trying to do. And an amazing thing happens there, because even though they had no idea about the technology, they begin to look at it with, through their own lens, and they begin to come up with recommendations of, now maybe we should change this, or we should do this, or we should do that. And then before you know it, there's a difference that occurs between what you came in with and what actually happens when you co-design. And so the post-design phase is now where you look back at your original plan, your original design or original plan, and then compare it to what happened when you implemented it and talked to them and redesigned it. And then you see where the innovation is. And so in terms of this project, it was really just looking back now at the, with the post design, I could see very clearly that initially my plan was, yes, I was just going to scale down what is done here in the advanced, in the developed world, scale it down to use little energy and not a lot of water, because we wanted to make it very few inputs into the system, because with inputs, that's more capital that has to be spent, or more resources that the people have to source. So we just want to make it minimal. And also the more important thing is the minimal inputs is minimal environmental impacts, because if you're using less water, using less energy, then you're leaving very little impacts on the environment as a consequence. And so I wanted to have it that way. And so I scaled down the design to make sure that, you know, it didn't have a lot of water or a lot of energy input. But by the time we designed the system, what we came up with was something completely different. And it was an open system, which you actually didn't need any energy on a day-to-day basis, and you needed almost no water. We started with some water, but we quickly realized that we did not need any, just maybe to clean up and stuff occasionally. And then even the process, you know, the process improvement was all coming from the women that I was working with. And so with that, we realized that not only were we going with this circularity idea, whereas the fact that you're actually taking bio-waste, which is, yes, waste from nature, waste generated without our interaction with nature, but then we you transform it to something that can be, that contributes back to nature. And so not just our biophysical system, but even human beings, because you get the protein replacement. The women, for instance, don't have to go to buy a commercial animal feed, because now they can just get the protein directly from the waste that they're generating, and then feed that to their livestock. Because in the area, most women actually have their micro livestock holders, and they're also smallholder farms farmers. And so as a result, there's that benefit that they can actually, you know, treat the waste and have additional source of income, but also benefit themselves and their families as well. And so that's how it just covers the all aspects of sustainability, which is the social, the economic, as well as the environmental, but also it's also empowering them, because they're learning and they're enjoying it. And then and the thing that the one key takeaway that I learned is that when you think you have, you know, how things are going to benefit people or how it's going to be detrimental to people, you actually don't know. You go in with some ideas, and then you learn so much from the people that you're talking to or you're working with, because the one big thing that they took away when they did all of this was, oh, we could actually teach other women how to do this. We can host teaching training sessions. And so to them, that was a big thing, which I had never even considered. And so, yeah, that's just how the research grew and grew.
That's incredible. Thank you so much for sharing that. And whereabouts did you do the pilot, the co-production, sorry?
Yeah, so I should have actually mentioned that. So yeah, thanks for asking. So this was in Dar es Salaam. It was a peri-urban community called Kipunguni with a group that is called Sauti ya Jamii Kipunguni. And what that means is in Swahili is voice of the community, Kipunguni. And they're a group that were formed because of the gender issues that they saw in their community. And it was mainly the female genital mutilation issue that they wanted. They started trying to fight. And with that, they realized, just as I had realized, that we need to have a source of income to be able to, you know, fight for these women, to represent them, to spread the word about, you know, like women should not be forced into these practices. It needs to stop. And so with help of international organizations as well as local organizations, they said, tailoring sessions, working as paralegals, trying to build skills so that they could represent themselves, you know, legally. And yeah, one thing just grew to the other. And then they also got interested in this waste to wealth concept. And I then got introduced with them by partnering with AmWef Health, which is an organization that looks out for the health of women in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania.
So with the bio-waste model, waste is kind of almost the soil of this innovation, if you were to talk about it in other terms. and I think within kind of Black communities around the world, when we're talking about environmental justice, environmental racism, one of the issues that comes up in those discussions is the idea of like waste and toxic waste in particular, and how there is a trend around the world in many different countries of Black communities, communities of color, living geographically closer to toxic sites, dumping sites, in comparison to other communities. And so there is already an awareness that waste is not just kind of a physical entity, but there's kind of social and political elements to this idea of waste. And I think the interesting thing about the bio-waste model is that it challenges our current concepts or understanding of what waste is, because in the dominant economic model, which is about, you know, extract, make, use, and then discard, waste is an inefficiency. It's almost like once something has no value, it no longer becomes, it becomes a nuisance. It becomes something that needs to be discarded, right? But then the bio-waste model challenges that and introduces a different idea of waste. And so I was curious to explore with you, this concept of waste not being waste, and how that has shown up perhaps in other cultures or just in the work that you're doing currently.
Yeah, no, that's a very good, very insightful lead up to the question that you gave there. You see, when I started this this research, I personally am interested in waste. I actually find it very curious and what we could do with it and, you know, where it ends up and what future generations will see when they go excavating, you know, because that's how we have learned about history, right? All the just digging up different Pompeii, you know, there's so many of these places, especially in Greek and, you know, the Middle East, how, you know, we actually learn about ancient history just by going through their sites, their waste, you know. So it's interesting to me to just ponder that sometimes. However, yes, there just does seem to be an injustice when it comes to waste. And there's a quote that I use many times. I think it was Jaya Singh that gave that quote. And it says, waste flows in the least path of resistance. And typically it's always into the poor neighborhoods. And so that path of resistance flow is consistently seen. So whether it's a developed country or an developing country, low-income communities will always have waste a bit closer to them than higher income communities. And it's just something that we consistently see. The brilliant thing about it, though, is many of those communities are very resilient. And so even in my time in Dar es Salaam, I could see like the waste that's been shipped to some of these countries, like in Dar es Salaam, the electronic waste, you can see them taking it apart and trying to look for, you know, minerals, you know, the rare ones they could extract or just look for something that they could get from this, from these discarded electronic devices. And so that's a positive, right? But to answer your question, initially when I started this research, I was really looking at what, having grown up in Nigeria, I was looking at, and I could see, it was very clear that the culture did not, basically frowned on wastage. And so it was almost like waste nothing. Like everything can be reused and repurposed. And so the tribe I grew up in is Yoruba. And so my culture frowned on anything wasted. My parents would have a fit if they see you waste anything at all, especially food.
Me too.
You
know? Me too.
And so it's common, you know, we understand it. You don't waste food. And so I was curious when I started exploring this thing of how do we now solve this waste issue? Because bio-waste, believe it or not, is actually in the developed, globally, it's about 44%. It's a fraction of waste. It's 44% of waste that is bio-waste. And so I was thinking, if we can actually deal with that on a global scale, then we're just left with, you know, something less that we can tackle in other ways. But the interesting thing is, when you now begin to go to developing countries, that percentage actually increases. It's now like between 50 and 80% of waste is organic waste that's generated local. And so then that's a low-hanging fruit, right? We can deal with that waste. And guess what? We've solved most of the problem in these situations. You just left 20% in some situations. And so I was just thinking, how can we then, you know, tackle it? And then remembering my parents and my culture and how I grew up and all of that, I started exploring this idea of indigenous cultures, indigenous practices, local traditional practices. And so I was exploring that, and it was curious to see that it was not something that was just limited to African cultures. Because, like, for instance, in Nigeria, idoti is really dust. It's something going back to dust, and that is waste. Idoti is a Yoruba word for dust and for waste. And it literally translates to something going back to the dust. And so that's how the culture saw waste. Like, it's not something that is harmful to us. It's something that goes back into nature. And the next thing I saw in Russia also, in the indigenous Russian cultures, their word for waste is trata. And that trata translates to a material that's waiting to be reused. And so their culture also saw waste as a material waiting to be reused. And so it's not waste. And then it's the same even in Latin America too, just checking their indigenous cultures, a similar thing. And so I thought to myself, okay, so somewhere along the way, we've missed it, you know, with modernization. We've started treating waste as something that is apart from us. Meanwhile, our generations before us, they saw that something that was part of them, something that was, you know, part, and that's why they treated waste in a completely different way. And so with new ideas, you know, we've talked about, you mentioned it's like a circular economy and, you know, industrial ecology and cradle to cradle concepts. Yes, that idea of, you know what, waste is not something that should be discarded and, you know, put away, put into a landfill, fill it up and cover it up and, you know, don't do anything with it. It's something that actually is a resource, you know. So just as money is a resource, you know, time is a resource, waste is actually also a resource. And so that idea, I decided, you know, we can actually build on it and begin to see how we can explore it in this particular situation, just going back to basics and how, you know, things have always been done. I don't know. I hope I answered your question.
You absolutely did. I'm just thinking and just really reflecting on everything that you've shared. What was powerful for me is how, you know, waste is also archival information. It's how we learn about like the histories, you know, our ancestral histories, which I've never even thought of that, to be honest. And then this idea of like the cultural idea of waste and how that varies very different from the modern or the current economic system that we is the most dominant in our world right now. The kind of the word for idoti and yeah, this idea of waste as dust, as a resource. And what was the Russian word that you mentioned?
It was trata.
Trata, yes. Yeah. Trata. And also just us, you know, we're two individuals with different life stories and how growing up, the idea of waste was, you know, is like a moral ill, you know, in both of, you know, our social communities where we're part of. And the reason why I laughed also is because it's a visceral experience for me. Like when I think about how waste is perceived, I can just imagine like the frowning or just the shock, like, wow, you're going to dispose of this? And like, are you actually okay? and I think...
Yeah, it was a taboo. Like,
how dare you? Like,
not with, but not that.
No, everything was used. Everything was used. And it brings me to a conversation I had with an amazing geographer from the UK. Her name is Francesca Rocchi, and she developed a platform called Black Geographers. And when we were talking about this podcast as an idea, one of the things that she said to me was how she wanted to see more conversations about our cultural practices in sustainability that are rooted in kind of the Black diaspora, African cultures. And one of the things that she raised was this idea of like zero waste. And she was saying like African parents are like, they're like pioneers of zero waste, you know, like you are not wasting anything. Everything will have value in this place. and that was a great insight in our conversation, but it also connects to that. What I also find very insightful about kind of what you learned about indigenous concepts of waste and how waste is seen as a resource or something that has value, intrinsic value, is that it mirrors a lot of what I've learned about how nature sees waste. So, you know, when you look at different ecosystems around the world, like when, you know, natural ecosystems, one of the most common kind of patterns is that everything has value in a particular system or a biome. Like there is nothing that can be kind of discarded outside the system, it serves the system. So what is waste to a particular animal or particular species is a resource for another species or another ecosystem, which very much connects to kind of the black soldier fly, you know, how it interacts with organic waste and then produces protein for animal feed. And nature also kind of shows how, I guess, whenever you're interacting with another living being, just to put it in crude terms, there is opportunity to provide mutual benefits all the time. So it's this kind of the value in interaction and what it produces, and there's opportunity for constant sharing of benefits. And I think that's something quite profound in the sense that it introduces an idea of like relationship and relationality. So you are also thinking about how can we create mutual benefit through our interactions? And there's something that we've touched on a little bit, but when I look at the idea of waste in nature, I think that the difference between kind of the cultural concepts of waste we've discussed and the idea of waste in the dominant economic model, which is about, you know, create, use, and then throw away, is that the goal of the dominant economic model that we live in is to continuously grow, continuously create and consume. So growth is the ultimate goal. And nature does not value growth for growth's sake. It doesn't, it because it values energy, it values materials so much, growing for growing's sake is like a threat, because what if you just suddenly run out of things? Then you're just gonna mess up everything. So this idea of growing for growing's sake is what produces so much of the, well, not all of it, but it's one of the main behaviors that we see in the economic model that we're operating in that ends up with us having waste that is inefficient, like it just exists because there is no purpose for it because we've produced too much of something. Whereas in nature, everything has a purpose and nature makes the most of what it has. It doesn't seek to just grow for growing's sake. So I find it interesting just like seeing commonalities between how nature perceives waste and how the kind of indigenous and cultural perceptions of waste. Waste is value, you know, and that's exciting. I think that's very exciting. I love having these conversations because there's so much of our world that we take to be fixed truths, but actually they're socially created. And if we seek to learn from each other, and we seek to learn from nature, we actually understand that there's different ways of, there are different concepts that serve us more in terms of creating life or creating goodness in the world, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. You sparked me, you sparked my interest.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, that notion of, being curious, it's so key because you don't know all things. No one is the gatekeeper of all truth. And so you have to be open to learn. And that's one of the big reasons why co-creation, co-production is so important. And it's not just important for when you're interacting with people of unequal powers, but it's even when it is equal power, because there's always something to learn from someone else's perspective. And yes, we learn from the past, very, very important, even though we try to forget it. We think it's all future, but we also learn from the past. So yeah, we all do have to be lifelong learners. I mean, we've heard that term before, but not just using the phrase casually, but actually be eager to learn from people, from each other, from nature, you know, from your experiences, from the past. You know, it's really important. That's how we grow. And I completely agree with you about the growth for growth's sake. There really is. You know, those capitalist notions that are completely unnatural are things that we do need to address. And that's another interest that I have taken, because economic systems is what forms a lot of the policies, a lot of the cultural norms, even the current traditions, you know, and the practices of what we see around us. It is economic systems that contribute to it. And so, yeah, just the thoughts that we just have to grow. It's just something that we have to do. It's completely unnatural. Or even the idea of, yes, businesses operate on the presumption of self-interest. I mean, self-interest never serves anyone. It has to be our interest, collective interest, and interest in other things, in the environment, and, you know, things around you. Or even the idea of what's the other one again? You know, that and a lot of these concepts that we have to reconsider. And that's why there is that push to rethink the role of business, to rethink, you know, our economic systems. And hopefully, you know, with the conversations going on, all something will happen.
Something has to happen. The bio waste model that you're working with, the Indigenous African women entrepreneurs, it's based on a particular type of economic model called circular economy. Or social circular economy. Well, we can tap into that. So, but I wanted us to explore a bit more about the idea of like circular economy, social circular economy, using the bio-waste model as an example, just to touch on that, because I think these are the types of economic models that we need going forward. So it'd be really great to also unpack what that actually means.
Yeah. It is a really good concept, because I mean, when I say that, I'm talking about the circular economy, because it actually builds on a lot of concepts that have, you know, that have come through time: industrial ecology, natural capital, cradle to cradle. You know, they're all of these things that build into this notion now that is pretty popular in the circular economy. And the idea of the circular economy is, okay, it's not just, get the natural resource, use, and then we discard at the end. But actually, now we can recycle, reuse, remanufacture, refurbish. There's a process now so that we reduce resource depletion and pollution, and then, of course, finally, waste generation. So with that idea, hopefully, you know, businesses now begin to rethink the way that they operate. And the circular economy is really, because of the remanufacturing and the refurbishment and all of these steps, it really is targeted to developed countries. And some of the principles, and I'm smiling because some of the principles, like this notion of the sharing economy that comes under the circular economy, is really exciting here in the developed country, in the developed world. However, when I read it and I was reading about it, I was like, this is how we grew up in Nigeria. Like, no, if you own this shovel, everybody on that street owned that shovel. No one on the street ever bought a shovel because they knew there was someone down the street that owned it. And like, it's the same thing. Like, if you have a basketball hoop for your child, That's the hoop that everybody in the community, in the neighborhood is going to play with. Unlike the systems that we have here where, you know, every house, you know, house by house, everyone has their own individual. And so, yes, the circular economy is basically saying, let's do it like, like these cultures have always done it and are still doing it. And so with that recognition that, you know, there's some things that it's introducing that are more targeted to these developed countries, then I saw that, okay, you know what? So this circular economy that we're going to use, we have to localize it. And that means we have to make it relevant to our context. And so with that, I just touched on a few key things that I thought the circular economy could help with, you know, which was like circular inputs. And so circular inputs were like renewable energies. And that's a focus, you know, not fossil fuel based, but they're going to use renewable energies. So that way you minimize pollution at the end of the entire process. And so I thought, okay, fine, let's use circular inputs. I thought about, you know, okay, job creation is another thing. However, let me just follow this trend of thought. So I just outlined the ones I thought were interesting. And then looking at other modifications of a circular economy, like the social circular economy, that one brought to my attention the need for a champion, a community champion. And so I thought that was very interesting because that means that even as I'm going in, the whole idea of the research was not just to implement another technology, but for it to be long lasting. And that's sustainable in my mind, sustained use of the technology. And so the idea of a product champion or a community champion was important. And from that, I tied that into one of the indicators that I was going to monitor. However, this community champion that I thought was very interesting and it was something I was going to pursue. By the time I got to Kipunguni, Dar es Salaam, I started working with this women's group. It was very, as soon as I raised the issue that, oh, we need someone to champion, they were like, no, we always have a project leader for everything that we do. And so it was already their practice. Like if there's something new, they nominated amongst themselves someone who was going to be in charge. And that person would just take it. And so you can see that there's some things that are recommended by certain systems, but you also have to always evaluate your current system and evaluate it with the people that you're working with and then see which ones can be dropped, which ones can be picked up. And so even at the end of the day, job creation was not an issue in our particular research because they were looking to use it for themselves and their households to benefit themselves, empower themselves, not necessarily scale, which is just grow. No, it was more of this can benefit us and it can benefit our community. And so we will keep it that way. And yes, I'll end it there before I go on and on.
Thank you so much. I think one thing that is important to also kind of share with our community is how a circular economy, for example, or a social circular economy is different from the current or the dominant, I would say dominant economic system that we have. Are you able to expand on that a bit? Some of the main features that make it different?
Yes. So the dominant model, economic model, is really what we say, take, use, and dispose. And so you just take it, you build it into a product, use it, and then you discard it. And so it ends up in the landfill. The circular economy, however, doesn't do that. It closes the loop by saying, okay, we take it, we produce, we use, and then whatever that is discarded, that's left over, we repurpose it by recycling it. By first of all, we try to reuse it in a different form. If we can't, then we try to modify it and recycle it, or refurbish it, or remanufacture it. And then as you're reusing it that way, you're not just discarding it. So it's not just a straight line, linear economy anymore. You're trying to refurbish, reuse, repurpose, and therefore you're closing that loop again. However, yes, there is that. We do know that as you're trying to refurbish, there's some amount of things that will be wasted along the way. if you're reusing as is, then of course there's nothing wasted. It's just you're using it for a different purpose. Say, for instance, a plastic cup, you use it in a restaurant or you have takeout, you bring it back home. Instead of just tossing it out, you decide to reuse it, you use it at home for many, many months. And maybe from there, one of your children takes it and uses it for arts and craft. It's reusing, or eventually you might discard it. And so just extending the life of that thing or repurposing or refurbishing it makes sure, allows waste to be reduced and closes that loop. So instead of just discard at the end, you actually just extending the lifetime and keeping it into that circle till finally, maybe somewhere along the line, yes, some of it is discarded. And so that's why it's called the circular economy instead of just the linear economy.
Thank you so much, Tunike. That was a really clear explanation. And I think I just wanted to expand on that because sometimes people may not understand why it's a circle, why it's circular. And so really having that definition of the process or the life cycle it's really fascinating. I'm excited by the work that you're doing because the environmental crisis, as it were, has raised up a lot of questions about our world. But one of it has to do with the economy, right? Because we understand that the dominant economic model, that linear model, has led to many ills, both in society and also in our natural world. And that manifests in climate, also in the climate's earth system. And I'm excited by the work you're doing to co-create and co-produce new models because it's helping us think about like what the purpose of an economy truly is. And, you know, as we've mentioned before, you know, our current, the dominant economic model globally is about infinite growth. It's about growth in pursuit of capital, right? You just have as much capital as you can possibly have, you know, and that has like serious issues for our world. And I wanted to use the idea of the GDP as a way to kind of talk about this practically. GDP is, it's known as the gross domestic product, and it's a type of metric that is used to measure how well a country's economy is doing, right? And what GDP, gross domestic product, it measures the value of kind of the goods and services that are produced and ready to sell, but the monetary value, not like the social value. So for example, if I have a business, a cleaning business, that is a particular service that's ready to sell in a market. But it doesn't measure many things. It doesn't measure our well-being. It doesn't measure standard of living. It doesn't measure the environmental health. So the health of the environment and, you know, what has been used to create that particular good or service. And it doesn't measure things that don't have monetary value. So just the idea that I can have a cleaning business where I go into other people's homes and clean their homes, and that has monetary value because I'm selling it for a certain price. But if I was at home and I'm taking care of like 100 people in my home and I'm working all hours of the day to take care of my family, that is not counted in GDP because it has no monetary value. So the GDP as a concept is flawed in so many ways, but the reason why it's problematic is because it exists to measure a certain kind of progress, and that progress is infinite growth of goods and services. And, you know, that has had implications for the environmental crisis because we're not measuring the health of the environment. We're not measuring the health of people, the well-being of people. And so now the environmental crisis is challenging us to actually think like, hold on, why are we using these metrics? Like, what is the purpose of an economy? An economy should exist to be in service of life. It should exist to be in service of the well-being of people, the well-being of the earth, you know, the well-being of social relations. So if that is, or if that should be the purpose of an economy, how can we think about different models that actually enable that? And so that's why models that like the one you're creating, Tinake, that's based on a social circular economy. There's ideas of like well-being economies. There's ideas of like donut economies. There's this really exciting, not even just conversations, but people actively applying these concepts because they're trying to create new worlds that are in service of life and life on Earth. So life for human beings, but life for other species too. And that's why I'm very excited, as I mentioned before, about what you're doing.
Thanks.
I think if, you know, a core part of the bio-waste model is also the African Indigenous female entrepreneurs. And I wanted to talk to you about that because it's more than just working with African Indigenous female entrepreneurs. It's also about their institutions. It's also about who they are and how that brings wealth and value to the bio-waste model, if that makes sense. Right. So I'd love for you to speak about that.
Absolutely. In fact, this is the part of the research that really got me gingered up when I started, because everything that I saw as a modern day problem, and I started to look back at the history and try to uncover that history, was so mind-blowing, liberating at the same time as exciting, you know. And it's the same thing with the waste. As soon as I started looking at waste, and as soon as I started looking at women, African women, and once you start to look at Indigenous African women, then it's just amazing. And then by the time I started looking at Indigenous African women institutions, that was another exciting you know, rabbit hole to go down. And what I learned, a few of the things I learned is, you know, prior to colonization, a lot of these African women institutions existed, and they existed as social groups. But the biggest one, believe it or not, were the business ones. And so it was these ideas of the market women, and they had a lot of power. They were not revered, but they were completely they were autonomous, they were strong, very strong institutions. And the evidence of their strength is the fact that they still exist in our modern day societies. And so any African community you go to, they still remain the Market Women's Association. And these are retail market women. And their institutions are still going strong. There are a few researches that I discovered as I was going along about the modern day ones. And they still are the ones that political candidates will approach if they want to have their names spread wide, because these women have links to the informal sector, and they just have they have the respect of their community because they've existed a long time ago. In fact, in Nigeria, a narrative I came across as I was doing the research was in Nigeria during colonization, when the British were trying to put a gender tax on the women just to subdue the women, because at the time the women were making a lot of, I mean, the women were in control. And so they wanted to make Nigeria reflective of what was in England then at the time, where men were the dominant providers. But in this this new place they'd come to, it was women that were the dominant providers. And so what they had done was they implemented a gender tax. And so the women were supposed to pay higher taxes to the government so that the men would at the end of the day, would come out will have more money compared to the women. And so these women decided to get together, and they actually, you know, they confronted the, they had a march. It was a peaceful protest. But then, sadly, a lot of them were actually violently attacked. They were gunned down. And it's just, and of course, there were targeted instances of where the head of these women institutions were targeted just to weaken the institution. However, the institution still remains very, very strong, even in Dar es Salaam, where I did the research. Because, for instance, we started collecting waste from the marketplace. And of course, who did we have to connect with? It was the same market women that were collecting the women, collecting that organic waste from. And once they understand what you're doing and they support you, yeah, the sky really is the limit. They would, you know, what you're doing, they will do everything within their power to make sure that it works. And so, yes, just the idea of, you know, the indigenous cultures that we had, the indigenous institutions. I mean, now the variations of it, because there are women's groups that are now religious based. There's still some that are social based. And then, of course, you still have the ones that are also economic based, like market women's group. And so all this work that I have done, or that I hope to do going forward, is really to recognize, you know, the role that women have had in these cultures, and hopefully to do something to contribute to them recognizing what they've always had, and then sharing that knowledge, and then hopefully allowing that knowledge to do something different than what the culture is propagating about African women, as well as African cultures and African institutions. It was beautiful, powerful in the past, and I believe that it can still be, just if we remember where we came from, what we had, and try to build systems around that. Not, of course, ignoring the benefits of modern technology, but actually localizing it in a way that builds on the things that we've always had and that maybe we've taken for granted or we lost. Try to just marry them together and, you know, get the best of both worlds.
Wow. Thank you so much, Tinuke. I feel like your mission is very much resonates with my mission and what I'm doing with this podcast. It's about remembering our place in earthcare, and that in many cultures, both within the continent and around the world, women are the gatekeepers of knowledge. We are the cultural bearers of knowledge when it comes to earthcare. And it's a very sacred duty. It's a very prestigious duty, right? Because if you don't know your environment, then you cannot survive, as we are seeing with what's happening in the world right now. And just this idea of like localizing, I think that's something that's also very prevalent in a lot of futuristic models of the economy. Speak a lot about localizing and understanding your local environment and really connecting with that on a deeper level. And that's something that nature does very well. Nature is very attuned to its local environment. It has to be able to respond and survive. So I just wanted to also thank you for really highlighting that in your research, that there are these institutions, there are these social roles that were played by African women, which predate so much of modern history in its many forms. and they are still continuing, and they have so much to offer in terms of teaching us about how to live in a way that makes the most of the values or the value that we have in a community, whichever way it looks like. It could be your social relationships, it could be economic value, it could be environmental value. There are like actual examples in history of where we've done that, and it still exists. And it, because they are resilient institutions, there's a reason why they've survived. They've survived violence and attempts to take them down, because by nature they are resilient, and they have a lot to offer us that we can learn from when we're thinking about different ways of living and creating systems that produce life going forward. So I just want to thank you for that, because I think that's a very crucial part of your research and the model you're co-producing. I feel sometimes we are seen in a certain way as recipients or victims or passive players in whatever sphere that we exist in. And it's important that as part of this work, that we actually take time to question those roles and to really look through new lenses, but also through histories to understand whether that is really aligned with the roles that we're being assigned. And that comes out very clearly in how you're working with them. I'm conscious that this conversation is coming to a close and I don't want it to end, but I had one question for you. So Black Soldier Flies are just doing the most. They're answering so many of like humanity's problems, like protein, like food, you know, addressing food waste, fertilizer. They're doing everything for us right now. And I think as someone who is very, my work is earth care, I do think a lot about our relationship with other species, other life on earth. And I say this because, you know, when it comes to Black Soldier Flies, you know, within the next decade, they're going to be the most farmed insect like in on the planet. Like currently 200 to 300 billion Black Soldier Flies are farmed for protein. So I just wanted to kind of, I guess what I'm trying to ask in my question is that I think part of, for example, designing economies for life is about economies that create life and well-being for humans and also other species. And, you know, how can we work with other species as equals, as partners in creating and designing new economies? Does that make sense?
No, absolutely. Absolutely makes sense. I guess if I interpreted the question right, it's more simple question of how we're making sure we're not exploiting, you know, this resource. Because yes, waste is now a resource, but of course the black soldier flies are also a resource. And so just have to be cognizant of the fact that we're not just taking, and then not allowing, you know, the flies or allowing whatever natural resource we're harnessing to also have the space to grow, you know, essentially, and not just us benefiting, you know, all the time. And so that, to answer your question, I actually stumbled into the answer that I'm about to give you. And I stumbled into it because we use the co-creation method. And so initially, in my pre-design, I was going to go in, like I said, with a scaled-down version of what we have here in the developed countries. And that was really, we capture the flies and we rear them, and then we use those reared flies to compost the waste. And then we capture some from the ones that are growing in the waste and we rear them. And so everything is in an enclosed system so that flies are captured. They're bred in captivity. And that's where that figure that you had, I actually didn't know there were that many that were being exploited. But and that's where it comes from, because you breed them. You know, it's like a farm. You're farming them. And so I had a scaled down version of that in my pre-design. But by the time I went to Dar es Salaam, just the culture and the ideas that other people had and the conversations, my design quickly changed to an open design. And what is that? That is really no more breeding of the flies. It's basically a big concrete bin. We dump the waste inside. The flies naturally occur in that, in the environmental parameters that are prevalent in that location. And so we just had to wait for a while, and then the flies come, the flies lay their eggs, the eggs they hatch to become larva, they grow, we harvest what we need from, you know, so the women are going to feed their chickens, they take out what they need to feed their chickens. We're going to sell some, if they're going to sell some, they take out what they want to sell. And but because the flies are free to come and go, they lay the eggs, the ones that we don't use grow into adults, they lay eggs, and so we allow the natural system to happen just by, yes, we source the waste and bring the waste to the place where they collect, where they come and they do their thing. We take from what we need and then we allow the natural system to continue. And so with that, we are essentially not just sucking the system dry. We're allowing the natural process to occur in as natural a way as possible. And like I said before, we're not adding energy into the system. Neither are we adding more water into the system. We just allow the system to, you know, to run by itself. If we want to have more flies, we just collect even more waste so that more flies will come and then they do what they're doing. And because we're giving them the food that they need to grow and grow quickly, then the system just naturally grows that way. And so with that system, I think it is not so much of us exploiting the resource, but actually benefiting as they benefit. So it's mutually beneficial. And so in my mind, that is more of a sustainable, what's the word I was going to use? A sustainable consumption, because we harvest as we need.
Thank you so much. Wow. Thank you so much, Chinike. This has been an incredible conversation.
Me too.
I am very grateful for the opportunity to speak with you and to learn from you. And I wanted to know how we can support your work going forward.
Well, honestly, that was really, really kind. I really appreciate the question. And the truth is, just having this, the work you're doing actually is supporting my work, because the conversations I would like to have going are the conversations we've had today, which is, yeah, let's take a look at the past for women in Africa, or women all over the world, women that generations and generations, whether it's centuries, can be traced back. Let's look at how they lived and try to learn from how they lived and see that we don't have to discard all that just because we want to advance in the future. And especially with the ones that are marginalized in our current days, we know that it's a modern thing. It's something that's happened over recent times. And so how can we go back to remind them about who they used to be, while also putting things in place that can actually encourage them and empower them, especially financially, and then hopefully everything else follows. And just having the conversation and you being able to us be able to talk about it, learn from each other and share the word, you know, that's honestly more than enough. So yeah, thank you so much for actually helping my work. This this conversation has been definitely a jewel, and it makes all the work that I had done in the past worthwhile. So yes, you've done more than enough. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I guess I should ask the same question. How can I be helping?
Oh, thank you. You're the first person that's ever asked me that on this podcast. I am so grateful. Honestly, continuing to pursue your passion, your dreams, centering that as the compass for living your life. I have a strong desire to have all women, all people, but especially Black women, center their dreams and their joy as a compass for living their life. Awesome. So I think for me,
you doing that
genuinely helps me. That genuinely, honestly helps me. And I hope it comes across through this podcast. You know, a lot of the people that I interview, you know, some of them started this work from a place of pain and survival. And a lot of them also are doing it because they just genuinely love it. And it's the most interesting thing in the world. And so the world needs people who have come alive. And so if I can be of service to that through our conversation, yeah, and you doing that really gives me motivation to continue. So,
well,
yeah.
I do have to say, you said if you could be of service by this through our conversation, you cannot imagine how excited or how exciting it has been for me, just because it's been years when I've been talking about Indigenous African women, and it's like, no one really, the spark never happens. It's like, what are you talking about? And so to actually have a conversation with you, and you get it, you understand, and it's, you know, and the conversation is going on, and it could go on for much longer. And that is, you know, it's definitely a gift.
It's amazing. Thank you so much, Tinuke.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you,
Marian.
Thank you so much for joining us on today's episode. We'd love to stay connected with you. You can subscribe to Black Earth Podcast wherever you listen to your favorite podcast. And you can also connect with us on Instagram, LinkedIn, and TikTok at Black Earth Podcast. See you in the next episode.